When you pull out your phone or, log into your banking app or check your 401k balance, who do you think actually controls that money?
Right, it feels like a really obvious answer.
Exactly. You probably think you do.
Yeah.
I mean, your name is right there at the top of the screen. You hold the password, you decide when to transfer it.
But there is a massive difference between experiencing the convenience of your money and actually possessing the structural power behind it.
Yeah, and that's exactly what today's deep dive is all about. We're going to reveal how a centuries-old financial architecture has quietly and honestly, almost invisibly redefined what it actually means to, own your savings.
Because those numbers you see on that screen, well, while they do represent your purchasing power, they give you a totally false sense of absolute control.
Yeah.
That sleek digital interface you use every day is essentially a mirage. It's masking a much deeper, much older structural reality about who really pulls the levers in the global economy.
And we're pulling our roadmap for this today from a fascinating 2026 book. It's by Wesley W. Fikes, and it's called The Digital Jekyll Island.
It's an incredible piece of research.
It really is. And our mission here is to unpack a core mechanism detailed in the book called the separation principle. So, in plain terms, it is a financial template perfected over hundreds of years that allows a tiny fraction of decision makers to dictate the flow of massive pools of public savings.
And it's crucial to understand right off the bat that this isn't some like glitch in the matrix.
Right.
And it certainly isn't a new Silicon Valley invention either. To really grasp how the separation principle functions right now in your digital wallet, we actually have to trace this exact same blueprint all the way back to 17th century spice
Which
merchants.
sounds crazy, but it connects perfectly.
Yeah, we follow it right through the industrial barons and watch it snap into place with modern digital stablecoins and the recent Genius Act of 2025.
And just to be clear, our goal today isn't to incite panic or tell you what to think. Fikes's book is just laying out the facts, and we're here to give you the clarity to see the financial architecture you're already living inside of.
Exactly. So let's start by defining the separation principle.
Okay, let's do it.
The foundational formula Fikes lays out is incredibly simple. Broad participation combined with narrow control.
Broad participation, narrow control. Got it.
Right. It is a deliberate structural division between the people who provide the capital, meaning you, the public, and the people who control the infrastructure and make the actual decisions.
So to see the mechanics of how this was born, we have to look at the early 1600s, right?
Yes, specifically the Dutch East India Company, known as the
Yeah.
VOC, and the British East India Company, the EIC.
Like the first real mega corporation.
Exactly. And they were facing this completely unprecedented problem at the time. They wanted to fund global trade, send massive armadas across the ocean, build international infrastructure.
Which obviously requires an ocean of capital,
Yeah.
far more money than any king or, small group of wealthy merchants could just cobble together on their own.
Right. They needed to tap into the public's money, the bakers, the blacksmiths, the everyday citizens.
But, and this is the dilemma, if you take money from thousands of ordinary citizens, you absolutely do not want thousands of ordinary citizens weighing in on your naval strategy.
Exactly. Or auditing your books, or demanding their money back just because a ship sinks.
I mean, to be completely fair, I wouldn't want that either. From an efficiency standpoint, centralization makes sense.
Yeah.
If I'm funding a 17th century galleon, I don't know the first thing about navigating the Cape of Good Hope, you know?
Right, or negotiating spice trades in Batavia.
Yeah. I want the experts making those decisions, not some committee of local cobblers. Isn't that just basic delegation?
Well, it starts as delegation, but you really have to look at how they legally coded that efficiency. They solved this dilemma architecturally. So the VOC created a specific class of ordinary shareholders called Participant 10. If you are a participant, you handed over your money, and in return, you received a share of the profits.
Usually paid out in actual spices early on, right?
Yes, literally bags of pepper and nutmeg. But here's the catch. You were legally barred from voting on company matters.
Wow.
You could not inspect the company ledgers, and crucially, you could not withdraw your initial capital. All of the operational, strategic, and financial power was locked away in a board known as the Heron the Seventh or the Gentleman 17.
So it's less like delegating a task and honestly more like being a silent partner in a restaurant.
That's a great analogy.
Like, you put up your entire life savings to build the place. You take the absolute worst of the risk if the building burns down. But the head chef decides the menu, keeps the lion's share of the profits, and legally bars you from ever stepping foot in the dining room or looking at the receipts.
That is exactly it. You are granted the economic experience of the investment, but you are structurally amputated from the governance. The risk and the funding are socialized out to the crowd, but the true power is fiercely privatized to the Gentleman 17.
But this is where I start trying to wrap my head around the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the 1600s. We've had centuries of legal evolution since then. We have modern corporate laws. We had the massive antitrust breakups of the 20th century. Surely those legal guardrails shatter that kind of blatant oligarchic control, right?
You would think so, but the research in Fikes' book argues the exact opposite. The system didn't break under antitrust laws, it just adapted.
Wait, really?
Yeah. The core mathematics of the separation principle simply changed its legal container. It migrated out of wooden ships and into the industrial era and then directly into the institutional era. And what's wild is that as the pools of money got bigger, the boardroom actually got smaller.
Let's track that shrinking boardroom for a second, because Fikes follows the history and the funnel of control compresses quite dramatically.
It does. I mean, the British East India Company was originally governed by 24 directors. Then the Dutch VOC consolidated their global empire under those 17 directors.
Right.
Now, let's fast forward to 1882 in the United States with the Standard Oil Trust. They faced the same problem, how to control a massive continent-spanning monopoly without ordinary investors getting in the way.
And they used the exact same template.
The exact same one. Thousands of trust certificate holders got a share of the oil profits, but just 9 trustees held 100% of the voting control over the entire empire.
So we drop from 24 down to 17 down to 9.
And the compression just continues. By 1913, you get the Federal Reserve Act. This creates a system where thousands of member banks provide the required capital, but monetary policy of the United States is dictated by just 7 presidentially appointed governors.
Oh, wow.
And notice the legal insulation here. Those governors serve 14-year terms. They are intentionally severed from the electoral cycle to ensure the public cannot just vote them out.
Let's bring this right into the listener's living room today.
Yeah.
Because the modern container for this math is your retirement account.
Absolutely.
If you hold a 401k, a pension, or an IRA, it's managed by what the financial world calls the big 3 asset managers. That's BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street.
And collectively, these 3 firms manage over $20 trillion in assets.
Trillion, with a T.
Yeah. So let's pause and look at the mechanism of that $20 trillion. What does managing your retirement actually grant them? We have to look at something called proxy voting.
Right, because when I buy a share of an S&P 500 index fund, I don't actually hold the voting rights for the underlying company.
Exactly. The asset manager holds those rights on your behalf. And because of a foundational 1919 Supreme Court ruling, it was Dodge v. Ford corporations are legally mandated to prioritize shareholder profit above all else.
So we, the public, are the economic shareholders. We put up the capital from our paychecks every 2 weeks.
Yes, but the big 3 exercise the proxy votes. They take your pooled money and use the sheer voting weight of that money to dictate who sits on the boards of almost every major corporation in the world.
We're talking energy companies, tech giants, food conglomerates, pharmaceutical firms.
All of them. They are casting the votes, shaping corporate policy, and driving global mergers, literally using your retirement savings as their leverage.
This totally flips the script on what we're usually taught about index funds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the common narrative is that index funds democratized finance.
That's what you always hear.
Right. They allowed the average teacher or construction worker to own a slice of the American economy. But practically speaking, Fikes points out that they just distributed the economic participation to millions of us while completely concentrating the actual governance of those companies into just 3 executive leaderships.
Broad participation, incredibly narrow control. It is the separation principle operating flawlessly at a global scale.
But controlling corporate boards, as massive as that is, isn't the whole puzzle, is it?
No, it's not.
Because a global financial system, especially one carrying the kind of sovereign debt we see today, can't run purely on stocks and boardroom votes. It needs cash. It needs what the financial world calls liquidity.
Exactly. The system requires a perpetual engine of raw cash. And to understand how they capture that cash, Fikes points us to a concept known as the Morgan mechanism.
Okay, take us back to 1913 again.
Right. So in 1913, there was a congressional investigation called the Pujo Committee. They were tasked with figuring out how a tiny network of allied bankers, led by J.P. Morgan, had managed to capture so much of the American economy.
And what did they find?
They discovered that this tiny small circle held 341 directorships across 112 major corporations.
So they were basically sitting on both sides of every single negotiating table in the country.
Yes. And future Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis famously dubbed their strategy other people's money. Here is how the loop actually functioned day to day. Morgan didn't use his own wealth to buy up these railroads and steel mills. He used life insurance companies and traditional banks.
Yeah.
Think about life insurance for a second. Millions of ordinary people pay a premium every single month without fail, terrified of what happens if they don't. It is a massive, unending river of public cash.
And Morgan just tapped that river.
He essentially dammed the river. The bankers took that pooled cash from the public's premiums and deposits, and they used it to buy corporate bonds. But not just any bonds. They bought the bonds that their own banking syndicates had originated for the massive industrial companies that they themselves already control.
Wait, let me make sure I'm mapping this out correctly. It's like a banker taking your checking account balance, using it to fund the mortgage on a massive commercial skyscraper that the banker personally owns,
yep.
And then charging your account a processing fee for the privilege of making the transaction. All while you, the depositor, are the one left holding the bag if the real estate market collapses.
That is the precise dynamic. The public provided the continuous, never-failing reservoir of capital. The bankers didn't need to risk a dime of their personal fortunes. They extracted the origination fees, they captured the yield from the bonds, and they maintained total operational control over the industries.
So the risk is yours, but the empire is theirs.
Exactly.
Okay, so the Morgan mechanism relied on life insurance premiums and bank deposits as its foundational reservoir of cash. But fast forward to the 2020s. We have a massive, soaring national debt.
Unprecedented levels of debt.
Right. And historically, the U.S. government relied on foreign countries, central banks, and global institutions to buy that debt. But lately, those traditional buyers are stepping back. They are tapped out.
So the architecture is facing an existential crisis. Where does it find a new ocean-sized reservoir of other people's money to absorb the national debt today?
And according to Fikes, the answer is sitting right in our pockets.
Yes. To answer that, you just need to look at your smartphone. The new reservoir is the digital stablecoin. This is what the source material refers to as the digital Jekyll Island. It represents the modern, ultimate iteration of the separation principle.
We're constantly sold the digitization of our money as a lifestyle upgrade. Like, it's frictionless, it's fast, you can split a dinner bill in 3 seconds on an app.
Right. But underneath the interface, its structural macroeconomic purpose is massive debt absorption.
And to see how that debt absorption is legally codified, the book breaks down the Genius Act of 2025. Let's walk through the exact mechanics of how this works, because the math is honestly staggering.
It really is.
Let's say you decide to convert $100 of your traditional bank cash into a digital stablecoin on your phone. To you, it's just digital dollars you can text to a friend. But behind the scenes, the company that issued that stablecoin takes your $100 in real cash and is legally required by the act to buy approved reserve assets to back up the digital coin.
Right. And what do you think those approved assets are?
Short-term U.S. Treasury securities, right? Government debt.
Exactly. Government debt. And here is the kicker. The U.S. Treasury pays yield, which is essentially just interest on that debt. Let's say it's 4-5%. If millions of people are holding hundreds of billions of dollars in stablecoins, that is billions of dollars in interest being generated every single year.
But the Genius Act explicitly, legally prohibits the stablecoin issuers from passing that 4-5% yield on to you, the person holding the token.
Yep. The issuer captures 100% of the economics. You get absolutely zero yield. You just get the convenience of a fast app.
So let's examine the asymmetry of that relationship.
Right.
What you're holding in that digital wallet is not actually an asset, is it?
No, it is a claim. An asset is a physical house, a piece of gold, something you hold free and clear. A claim is just a digital IOU. It relies entirely on the solvency and the permission of the issuer.
So if that stablecoin company goes bankrupt,
or their servers get seized, there is no FDIC insurance bailing you out. There is no lender of last resort backstop for your digital wallet. The risk of the entire enterprise is fully socialized onto your shoulders, but the billions in yield are completely privatized to the issuer.
You are the 17th century participant all over again. You are providing the base capital, but you are structurally severed from the true economic benefit of your own money.
And we can't ignore the governance side of this equation either, because if issuing these digital dollars is essentially a license to print billions in free yield, who gets to decide which tech or finance companies are allowed to do it?
I knew we were going to end up back at the shrinking boardroom.
Oh, absolutely.
The Genius Act created a regulatory gatekeeper to handle exactly this. It's called the Stablecoin Certification Review Committee, or the SCRC. And the number of people who sit on this committee is astounding. It's exactly three.
Just three people.
The Secretary of the Treasury, the Chair of the Federal Reserve, and the Chair of the FDIC. That's it.
Mm.
And to let any non-financial public company into this highly lucrative system, they require a unanimous vote.
So let's look at the historical funnel of control one more time. We started with 24 directors in the East India Company, shrank to 17 in the Dutch VOC, down to 9 trustees in Standard Oil, down to 7 governors at the Federal Reserve.
And now the architecture dictating the future of digital currency is controlled by just 3 individuals.
It is the absolute pinnacle of the separation principle. Participation expands globally to billions of smartphone users, but governance compresses down to 3 gatekeepers.
So synthesizing everything Fikes lays out here,
uh-huh,
by simply using a beautifully designed digital payment app to buy my morning coffee, I am completely unknowingly acting as the primary financier of the U.S. national debt.
Yes, and you can see how it forms a self-sustaining closed-loop architecture. In your professional life, your 401k contributions finance the corporate infrastructure, handing over proxy voting control to 3 massive asset managers. In your daily life, your digital purchases via stablecoins finance the national debt, handing over the yield to the token issuers.
Wow. You are the continuous engine for both sides of the global economy, yet you control neither.
Exactly. And the brilliance, and I use that word carefully, the structural brilliance of this, is that it doesn't require any villains plotting in a smoky back room.
Yeah.
It doesn't require an authoritarian government violently confiscating your bank account.
Right. There's no cartoon bad guy.
Right.
It is entirely driven by convenience, compliance, and subtle legal frameworks.
Because the architects of modern financial control know that using force is incredibly inefficient. Force creates friction. It causes resistance. Instead, you build an architecture based on dependency. First, you make the alternative to the digital system highly inconvenient.
Like trying to pay for a flight in physical cash. Good luck.
Exactly. Then you pass laws making cash transactions look suspicious. Finally, you just let the digital network effect render the physical alternative completely obsolete. The public walks into the cage voluntarily because the Wi-Fi is good.
But wait, what about the crypto ecosystem? There are millions of people who buy Bitcoin or other decentralized currencies specifically because they understand everything we just talked about. They don't trust the Fed, they don't trust Wall Street, and they believe that holding crypto completely severs them from this architecture. Does Fikes address that?
The research addresses this illusion directly. Fikes argues that in many ways, the wild, chaotic volatility of the early crypto boom actually served a crucial psychological purpose for the broader financial system.
How so?
It conditioned a generation to accept abstract digital ledgers and IOUs in place of physical assets. It was basically a training ground for the digital wallet era.
To get us comfortable with money that we can't touch.
Precisely. But more importantly, there is a fundamental misunderstanding about what decentralization actually means. People confuse the protocol layer with the identity and access layer.
Break that down for me.
Sure. So yes, the protocol, like the global network of Bitcoin miners solving complex math, is highly decentralized. No central bank controls that code. But the protocol doesn't exist in a vacuum. To actually use your crypto to buy groceries or pay rent or convert it to something broadly accepted, you have to pass through an on-ramp or an off-ramp.
You mean an exchange?
Right.
Like an app like Coinbase or Binance?
Yes. And those gateways are fiercely regulated. They require KYC, know your customer compliance. You have to hand over your ID, your social security number, your facial scan.
So the moment your personal identity attaches to that decentralized ledger through a regulated gateway, you are immediately yanked back inside the architecture.
Exactly. To put it another way, the ocean might be free for anyone to sail, but the government controls every single port. And if they control the ports, they control the trade.
The separation principle wins again.
It does. Yeah. You might have decentralized money, but you still have centralized access.
Man, let's take a breath and look at the massive terrain we've just covered from the digital Jekyll Island. We traced a mathematical blueprint that started in the 1600s. Where the Gentleman 17 separated the capital of ordinary citizens from the control of a global naval empire.
Right.
We watched that exact same blueprint migrate into the 1913 Morgan mechanism, where bankers used the endless river of life insurance premiums as other people's money to consolidate American industry.
And today, we see it operating perfectly through a three-person committee.
Yeah, gatekeeping. A digital stablecoin system that uses your everyday coffee budget to quietly absorb sovereign debt, all while ensuring you never see a single dime of the interest.
It is an incredibly resilient historical pattern. And the reason we are unpacking all this for you, the listener, is because understanding this architecture is really the only way to maintain your agency in a digital world. It fundamentally comes down to recognizing the hard line between an asset and a claim. An asset is something you truly own. You control the risk, you capture the reward, you hold the power.
Whereas a claim is nothing but a ledger entry on someone else's server.
Exactly. It is a promise entirely contingent on their permission, their rules, and their solvency.
And in a world accelerating toward fully programmable money, recognizing that difference isn't just like financial trivia. It is a matter of personal sovereignty. Once you see the blueprint, you can't unsee it.
You really can't.
You can intentionally decide how much of your wealth you want tied up in real assets versus how much you are willing to let drift into a system that happily uses your capital, harvests the yield, and structurally denies you a seat at the table.
Because the separation principle only works when the participants are focused on the convenience of the interface rather than the mechanics of the engine.
That's a perfect way to put it. So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to explore on your own. Everything we've discussed today, this entire closed-loop architecture, currently relies on the fact that you still technically have a choice.
Right, for now.
If you don't like the terms of the digital ledger, you can still withdraw physical cash. It might be cumbersome, it might be outdated, but physical cash is final, and it is private.
Yeah.
But as the relentless push for digital efficiency drives physical cash closer and closer to total extinction, what happens to your freedom to disagree when opting out of the payment network is no longer practically possible.